Welcome back, Crusaders, to the Nerd Crusade Podcast. I'm your host, Ian, and with me, as always, is Courtney.
Hello.
This week, we are a little late, but that's because I was sick. But
very sick.
The good news with that is that we have watched all of Shogun, and we can wrap that up for you.
Yes.
We've also watched all of Renegade Nell, so we can talk about that show as well. And then we saw a movie called Susume on Netflix. And then there's a couple games that I've tried out so far before the Fallout 4 next-gen update comes out, which will be not till the 25th, which should be tomorrow. But first, let's jump into Shogun. Last two episodes was called Crimson Sky and Dream of a Dream, and it was definitely very interesting. Crimson Sky, where we thought everything was going to kind of hit the climax, it kind of does, but it doesn't end. It's not like it's not like the last episode is just a wrap-up. The last episode kind of explains everything that's been actually really going on.
Mm-hmm.
But Crimson Sky was definitely an interesting episode where Blackthorn and
Mariko
and Yugashi go to Osaka. Mariko ends up going with them on orders from Torinaga, basically to get Torinaga's like consort, his newborn child, and
His rest of his family members are trapped in there.
And
out.
And that's the thing is that Ishido and Osaka, they've been holding all the lords and ladies of all the different major families of the realm. They're kind of hostage, but not hostage. They're not being told that they're captives. They're being told they can leave anytime they want, but yet they can't leave. Kind of like what they accused Torinaga of doing to the heir's mother, where like she asked Torinaga to go to Ido, and they said, well, you're holding her prisoner. And he's like, I'm not. If she wants to leave, she can leave. And then she immediately came back to Osaka.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like she had sent the studio saying, hey, I'm being held captive here. I need to leave, to kind of kick the whole thing off with them, with the regents wanting to go after Torinaga, saying he was too much of a threat.
Yeah.
Basically because, as we know, the heir's mother thought that Torinaga was the one who plotted against killing her father and all that type of stuff, which...
A little bit.
It's not clear whether it was his idea or not, but it's definitely Mariko's father who did it. But so he sends Mariko there, and knowing that like they weren't going to let her leave, and then basically the trump card that they play here is that Mariko says, "We're leaving tomorrow morning. I have to obey my lord. If we're not captive fears, I should be able to leave." And then they try to stop, saying, "Oh no, you need to have a permit to leave."
Yeah.
And she says, "No, I'm leaving." And the next morning, they have guards try to stop them. Her guards fight them, kill a bunch, to the point where then it's just her left fighting off the rest of the guard. To a point where she says, this is impossible. I can't defeat all these men. We are not being invited here. We are being held captive. And because I can't leave, I must commit seppuku by sunset.
And she says this while all the other family members... Or not family members, but all the other royal families are up on the barracks
and the regents
watching
are
down.
All watching too, yeah. And the Christian regents don't want her to die because she's a Christian. And she's very influential.
Yeah, she's a very highly influential woman in court.
Yeah, to the point where when their regents are discussing it, the heir's mother basically says she can't be harmed because if she dies or she kills herself, all the lords will revolt against you for letting her die. And if you leave, they're all going to ask to leave too. So
you're in a catch 22 is what's happening.
Yeah.
By her coming back to Osaka.
And then,
when she meets him in the, big throne room, that was really powerful to show just how much power Mariko has over so many people.
Yeah, as they try to shut her up, she said, no, I'm not going to be quiet. You're going to listen to me. This is what I have to do. This is what my lord ordered me to do. I'm going to do this whether you like it or not. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And this all comes down to, okay, now she's going to commit seppuku, and then the regent's like, we can't have that happen. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do?
And during this time, Mariko meets with the church. I forget the... It's not the head priest.
It's the Portuguese guy.
It's the second Portuguese guy.
The guy that gets to open up the church in Edo.
Yeah, next to the whorehouse.
Yeah.
And
like she gives her last confession to him and says some stuff to him.
That we don't know what she says till the next episode is revealed.
And the, Then she had also asked, I think, Lord Ishido to be her second.
Yes, which is one of the Christian lords, head lords.
Yeah, he's the head of Osaka, but he refused to show up. So Blackthorn steps up and says he'll do it. And right before it's about to happen,
yep,
Ishido shows up and throws down, like, here's your permit, you can leave in the morning.
So that prevents her from dying, at least.
Yeah. But he then contacts Yuguchi, who do say, hey, if you want to prove your loyalty and we don't kill you, you got to do something for me, which is he has to let assassins in that night.
Yeah, the shinobi come in to
try and capture Mariko and stop her from leaving.
Yeah.
But all hell breaks loose, basically. They kill all the guards and everything, and they're trying to kill everyone else.
They kill the guards, they kill a lot of servants some of the family, not the consorts. But before that, Mariko and Blackthorn do share a passionate night together. Spoiler one last time.
Which it's when the shinobi come in, though, it's like it's unclear. They're there to capture Mariko. Which
yes, because you see them grab her, because Blackthorn is with her, and they're trying to kill Blackthorn. But you see two or three of them grab her and try and just pull her out, as opposed to kill her.
Yeah,
like they're you've been seeing them just due to everyone else.
Where they're gonna kill the Toranaga's consort wife or child and all that? They probably were. I thought.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were going to kill them. But they were
going to keep Mariko alive.
But they were going to keep Mariko alive.
So,
because, again, she has more influence.
They attack the Yushi guy, lets them all in, and then he pretends to be a victim. Like, oh, my God, there's guards here, and, like, sounds the alarm. Mm-hmm. When it's way too late.
And Blackthorn kills a couple guys with his guns and swords.
Yeah, Blackthorn, like, gets to, like, shoot the fuck out of people.
Oh, yeah, that was cool to see him finally, like, be able to use his guns in a fight.
And actually, like, have a fight, right?
Yeah.
But they end up all running towards a storage building to kind of blockade themselves in. Which, it's like the consort, or Toranaga's consort, his child, Mariko, like, all the rest of Toranaga's family. Yugashi's there, Blackthorn's there, Mariko. But they hear that the shinobis are setting charges on the door.
To blast it open. And Blackthorn's trying to get a box or something to help block it.
Block it, but, like, he needs help. Yushiro's, like, just sitting there, like, in his grief that he's let this happen, and
he fucked up.
He fucked up big. Like, he's realizing he fucked up real big. And then Mariko just says, no, let it go, and stands by the door. And then
to block it.
Episode ends with the door exploding.
And you see it explode around her. And kind of threw her a little bit.
Yeah, like, there's no way she survived that.
Yeah.
And, like,
that's ends. And we're like, oh, shit. Can't wait for next week. Next week rolls around.
Yeah.
We're back in the thick of it. Door just exploded. Blackthorn's waking up.
Yeah, and episode 10 is called Dream of a Dream, which is kind of weird because they have a flashback throughout this episode. And it's a very short flashback that happens, like, two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's Blackthorn on his deathbed as an old man, and his grandchildren are looking at his samurai swords, trying to ask him, like, hey, did you really get this from savages? And he doesn't say anything. It's just, like, he's looking back into the past. But it's, like, it happens at times where, like, Blackthorn, like, looks off and is thinking of something as if he's dreaming of his old age, or his old age is dreaming of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not very clear either, because it's never really explained the whole thing.
And I kind of like that. So it leaves it up to the viewer on how they want to view it. And I think as you watch through the rest of this episode, you come to a conclusion, it's probably him looking to the future.
Yeah, and it's
especially after a certain scene that we'll discuss later.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because I don't see them doing a season 2 to this.
You, like, can't. It's,
like,
done.
Like, the story's done at this point, and it's left for interpretation where you're like, they could sit there and say, no, let's see another season with Blackthorn and what's happening next, cause maybe some new thing, or have it be more him adapting to the culture. But I think need to end it here, and that's a good way to end the story.
Because it ends with the Shogun ruling.
Yeah, but with Toranaga's always going to give power back to the heir once he's old enough. And this whole, like, propaganda that he was a threat was just because he controlled large military power. That's what the mm-hmm. shogun is. The shogun is the person who controls the most military might in Japan, so therefore they are the most powerful person in Japan. And it's always fear that the shogun will never give up his power to the rightful ruler or to a ruler if they're the shogun. And this whole story is how Toranaga actually does become the shogun. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of not clear from episode one that that's what we're going to be watching. We think that it's that we don't even realize that that's his ambition, really. His ambition is to protect the heir and like let the heir take his place to rule, and yet everybody else wants to kill him for some reason.
Right.
Because we know that the heir's mother thinks he's to blame for killing her father. The other regents think he's too powerful, when he's done actually nothing of aggression to anybody yet.
Mm-hmm. It's only when they're forcing him into that aggression that he finally snaps.
Yeah, it's basically a self-fulfilling prophecy. Them trying to remove him from power makes him more powerful.
Right.
So, in the last episode, Blackthorn and Yusuke and them, they all get to leave.
Yeah.
They find out, Blackthorn finds out from the priest that escorts him out of Osaka that arrangements were made that he doesn't get killed, that he was going to be allowed to leave Japan freely.
Mm-hmm.
So they get back on the boat and they sail back to the first village.
Yeah. Oh, and Mariko was buried in a Christian burial. And originally they were going to try and not have her buried or any kind of pomp and circumstance because of her lineage. But the Aaron's mother spoke up and was like, no, she's going to get full fucking rights because and everything.
As much as the heir's mother was against the people who killed her father, even though it was Mariko's father who did it,
she loved Mariko.
That was her best friend growing up. That was her only connection. Escape from her internal prison as being a consort kind of thing.
Yeah.
Was through Mariko. So her dying, she said, no, we're going to give her proper burial. We're going to give her her rights.
Yep. And she even writes out Mariko's last poem.
Yep.
Or death poem, which was very beautiful.
Because basically her dying in this attack, one, it's very clear that obviously
that's what Toranaga was setting up.
Yeah. And like Ishida tries to play like, oh, Toranaga did this. And it's like, no, Toranaga would not have done this. Nobody's mm-hmm. going to believe that, even though that's what he's trying to pitch to the regents and to the people. All the lords and everybody, as the heir's mother said, are going to revolt against him because he's not, because Mariko's died and he didn't allow her leave. The only saving grace he has is that when they come to a battlefield, because Toranaga is now no longer going to surrender because Mariko died, that he'll have the heir's banner on his side, which will make him lawful.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that only card he has left to play. And he thinks he has it because he's marrying the heir's mother. The family's going to be connected, and so therefore he should have the heir's banner on his side. But
well, hold off on that.
They end up letting Blackthorn and the survivors all go. They all leave. They get back on the ship. They head to the other village
where that Blackthorn was staying at with Fuji, and the ship was.
Yeah, where his ship was. This is where Toranaga has run off to. Like, basically, they got where the Toranaga left Ito. They don't know where he's at. He's went back to this village. And when they get there, that's when Blackthorn sees that his ship has been torched and it's sunk.
But before they see it, Blackthorn was talking with
Yusuke or whatever.
Yusuke.
The guy who boiled the guy's been sitting on the fence the whole time. He's begging that Blackthorn take him to England and get him away because he knows he has to commit seppuku.
Yeah.
Like, he's his lord. He's fucked.
Yeah, he's basically betrayed both lords. He's fucked. And he's trying to find a way out to still live. And
the point where he's like, show me how to die. I'm like, you should Toranaga. Like, he's like trying to
be friends with him.
And doesn't understand, like, that's not how this works.
Yeah. And then when they come around the corner, they see
that the ship has been burnt and sunk. They get to the town and Toranaga's men are killing villagers, trying to find out who set the ship on fire and sunk it. All Blackthorn is told, like, hey, some Christians came in, they had some help, and they destroyed your ship. To where, basically, Blackthorn puts together that Mariko's deal, that because when he leaves, the priest finally tells him as he leaves that, hey, the person who secured your life is Marco. She made a deal with the church to spare your life. And then when he sees the ship being burnt down and hears that Christians did it, he puts together that her deal was destroy his ship, he gets to live.
Yep.
So he puts that together and tries to tell Toranaga that, hey, dude, no, this is not, Marco did this to save my life. I'm the enemy, not the people. Stop killing people in the village trying to find those who help the Christians.
Right.
Because
Blackthorn has really grown to love these people and considers them like kind of as part of his crew and family.
Yeah.
The old fisherman that's secretly
the samurai.
The old samurai is now kind of his only interpreter. And also what's nice about this episode, we see Blackthorn really start to communicate more in Japanese, and his vocabulary has grown quite a bit. And
also he's
understanding conversations, and also he's really understanding the culture and the way of the Japanese people. And he's become more assimilated to the culture.
Yeah. And like,
he's really starting to accept it more and more.
Yeah. Like he's seen the disgust of like his own, what his men were doing, which they kind of leave him like, we never know what happened to his men at all. He just basically, he's abandoned that because he sees what they are. He's like, they're disgusting. Like, Chris, I don't want to be that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They really are barbarians compared to these people. And then he has a sit down with Fuji, who tells him that, hey, I'm leaving. My service to Toranaga is over. I'm going to go be a nun.
I've been given permission by Toranaga to become a nun. And she's all proud and happy. And he's Blackthorn's like, but like, because she's kind of like his last connection with Mariko and that transitional life.
Hey, he tries to order her to know, I want you to stay. Order it.
She's like, no.
I'm my service is done. You can't order me around. I'm no longer your consort.
Yeah. And then they have a really nice dinner together, where they were kind of able to have a conversation, which was great. And she points like, yes, and I'm going to take my son and my husband's ashes with me to be properly put in the
temple
or temple shrine. But
Blackthorn takes her out actually on a boat.
Yeah, towards the end of the episode.
And says, hey, no, come with me. And she's like, are you going to row me to the...
She's like all no. laughing. And he's like, no, I have something else in mind.
Yeah, and he basically brings the remains of her son and her husband with him. And he says, hey, to me, we burial at sea means people are never without us. They're always there with us. They're traveling. Like, it's a deep thing for him. Kind of explains that to her. And then they both...
And she understands. And he helps her. And she agrees. And
pours the ashes overboard.
Which I'm like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
And so then, she can finally let go. And you see her finally be able to let go. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah. And then he has Mariko's cross.
Yep. And during the flashbacks, you see him holding that cross.
Yeah.
When he's a old man. And you see Fuji reach out to him and tell him,
let your hands be the last ones to hold her. And then he drops the cross into the water.
Yeah. Which makes me think like those flashbacks.
It was him thinking of the future.
Yeah.
And yeah, and thinking of like what his life, if his life would be regretful, and that like the stories his grandchildren learned was that they were savages that he met.
Yeah.
Whereas letting go of that cross and that not being the future means that's not what will be taken away from this. That maybe he will stay in Japan, maybe he won't, but he won't. It won't be a story of a sailor who went to a different land, met savages, and brought back his souvenirs.
Right.
Toranaga
is going to be. We didn't mention this quite yet, but when Toranaga and I can never pronounce his name.
Yugushi or something like
that. Yeah, Yugushi go for Yugushi's
seppuku. Yeah, he has to do seppuku by sunset the next day. So, like, they're setting that all up. He wants his nephew to be his heir, but Toranaga says, like, you don't have the right to give anything away.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe Toranaga's probably going to give it to his nephew anyway.
Yeah, because the nephew has been proving himself to be pretty damn loyal to Toranaga.
He arrested his uncle for Toranaga.
Yeah.
Because Toranaga got a letter from from one of his consorts or whatnot that he was in the basement with him crying and pleading for his forgiveness. To the point where, like, before they even left Osaka, Shido came to thank him for what he did. And he was kind of delirious. He was still
shell-shocked. He was very much a broken man.
And yeah, because he knows he's fucked up to where he repeated the story of like, yeah, remember when this one emperor wanted to go to war against all the five clans, but like an earthquake stopped him, and he blamed it on the catfish swimming his tail so much to cause the earthquake mm-hmm. in this lake. And she was just like, oh, that's an old story or whatnot. But then he's like grabbing for a catfish in this pond where there's no fish.
Yeah.
To where like she realizes like this guy's lost it. He's not useful anymore.
Yep.
But like lets him go. To where Toranaga basically tells him, because of your betrayal, you're going to commit seppuku by sunset the next day. And that's probably the biggest scene in this whole thing, which we'll get to in a second, mm-hmm. is that sequence with him and Toranaga. But when Blackthorn asked to have eyes Toranaga to try and explain to him that Mariko is why the ship was sunk. Stop killing people in the town.
Or I'm going to
kill seppuku myself because I'm the enemy. I'm the one who's been filling you full of shit and wanting you to help fight my war against the Portuguese, which isn't really what was important here. He's to the point where Blackthorn was about to kill himself and Toranaga stops him.
Yeah.
And basically tells him that he can rebuild his ship and that he needs to build him a fleet.
Yes.
Well, that's going to take, forever, right?
Yeah. But it gives Blackthorn a purpose.
A purpose, now. Yeah. So.
So, and that's kind of a scene where Blackthorn is reborn as well. That and yeah. also when he goes out with Fuji.
Yeah, and that's where he's told by the old fisherman that old fisherman's actually a samurai. He was the spy that he's basically brought in kind of into the whole what was going on. To some extent, to where he's no longer an outsider at that point.
Yeah.
And he said, he was reborn at that point, where he's no longer the barbarian, he's no longer the outsider.
He's no longer Anji.
He can move on and has a purpose to be loyal to Toranaga as mm-hmm. he sees fit. Now, this takes us to the scene where Yoshigo is taken to Toranaga on a cliffside where he's supposed to commit seppuku, and that's where he's asking, this is all for naught, dude,
You're going to die.
Like if we can't attack, if we attack Osaka
with Crimson Sky,
it'd be a glorious battle. Maybe I could see that. Maybe I could see you in the glorious war or my nephew run this town or whatnot. And Toranaga's like, no, there's no days for that, right?
Yeah.
And this is where Toranaga kind of explains everything that's going on.
Yeah, he said Crimson Sky already happened. Yeah. When I sent Mariko, that was Crimson Sky.
Yeah, he said, I sent a woman to do what an army of men couldn't do.
Yeah.
And this is where very important because this explains everything that's been going on. I feel like a lot of people, without this, you wouldn't understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And even with this explanation, I think a lot of people might go over their head a bit. Is that Toranaga sent Mariko there to die when we're there. He knew that she was going to go there, and they wouldn't let her go. So she would either have to kill herself, or
be killed while trying to leave.
Yeah, or they'll let her go, and they'll try and kill her either on the road or before she leaves or something like that. So he knew, and she knew she was going to die. Because before she left, he said, are you ready to do what you need to do? So she knew she was going there to die.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the reason why she stood in front of the door and let it kill her, because it's what needed to happen. Like we said, her dying means all the regents, families, all that are against Ishida. The only thing he has is the heir's banner to make his war lawful against Toranaga.
Mm-hmm.
But Toranaga got a note from the heir's mother.
Yeah, who gave it to one of his consorts.
And that he reads and he doesn't tell us what it is until the scene happens where he explains to Yugishio that, hey, there will be a battle. The five armies will meet on this battlefield. But he won't have the banner because the heir's mother was so upset about Mariko dying that she's pledged that the heir's army, he will not have the heir's army at his back.
And she will not marry him either.
And that the regents will then turn all their swords against him and Ishida will lose. And I have brought peace to the lands without ever having to have a war.
Yep.
Because this whole thing was leading up, making you think it was leading up to this big battle, which we never get to see. But instead we get to see a political strategist outmaneuver everybody,
mm-hmm.
and then with the sacrifice of a few people, he ends up winning and bringing peace to the country without having to go to a massive war to kill everybody.
Yeah, and becoming a shogun without bloodshed.
Yeah, that was the big point. The other big reveal here that's kind of on the side that is that he knew about Mariko's deal, and he was the one who set it up so that they could destroy the ship. And he killing the villagers and questioning them was just for show, again, to show that, hey, he knows somebody on Ishida's side, like, snuck in and did something, right? Mm-hmm.
All to kind of throw off Blackthorn.
Yeah.
And he said, like, Blackthorn, and then he even asked, like, well, why keep Blackthorn around? And he said, because he makes me laugh.
Yeah. And he said, Blackthorn
is never leaving Japan.
I don't think he's just never to leave Japan. He makes me laugh. And he said, hey, remember when Yugoshi's like, what's the whole point of this, of your war? It's pointless. He says, remember what the barbarian said when he told me about his war? He says, unless I win. It's like, if I win, nothing's pointless. Mariko's death, the death of the old guy who was blamed for the spy, his best friend's death, all this death that's happened is not in vain because he won the war of, like, becoming shogun, taking down his enemies without bloodshed, and keeping the heir where he's going to end up becoming the emperor, which is fine, and not losing anybody in his immediate family, right?
Right.
This is, like, a really good political strategy show. Like, what Game of Thrones was doing, what Game of Thrones' big move for everything was, we're just going to kill people.
Yeah, we'll just... Yeah,
somebody's in your way, we're going to kill this character. This person seems like my character, we're just going to kill them. That was their answer to every political strife they ran into, where...
And it wasn't, like, strategic either. Throughout this entire series, it was all strategy, and it was so interesting to watch it play out.
Yeah, and, like, everything Toranaga did was already planned out. He knew what he was doing. Even the shock that his friend killed himself because he didn't tell him the plan, the shock that the fact that his son had died worked to his advantage, even though he didn't want that to happen. But even when he sees his consort and his son, and they say, yeah, we're sorry for the loss of your son, he says, I understand, but I have other sons.
Yeah. So it's like, clearly he has plenty more sons and children in the background that we never met.
And even though his oldest son seemed to be somewhat of a disappointment, he is thankful that his son bought him more time.
Yeah.
Which helped this plan come to fruition. So, like, here's a show that builds up that there's going to be this big battle, big war, maybe, that we never get. But
don't feel disappointed. Yeah. Some people might feel disappointed because they're like, oh, we want to see big battle. But no, I think this payoff is so much more satisfying and so clever. And I even love the last shot where you have Blackthorn pulling... with the villagers.
Pulling the ship out of the water.
Pulling the ship out. So, and then you also see Mariko's
husband
come and help. And you see his husband, or her husband, it looks like he's trying to, like, mend fences with Blackthorn as well. And you see Blackthorn reborn in that moment. Like, he's going to be part of this village. He's going to rebuild his ship. But as soon as he rebuilds it, you know, well, it blew up or burnt down, but he doesn't know that. But right now he is happy, he is content. And then you pan over and you see Toranaga, the back of Toranaga, and that great shot of him silhouetted, and then boom, shogun.
Yeah. it's definitely a really good payoff to have him explain it and to see that here's somebody who won a political strife without being barbaric and having to kill it hundreds of
thousands. Without even having to do a war.
Yeah. Which is rarely ever seen in these shows. Because all these shows always go to, like, we're going to have a big battle, have a big war, right?
But we're going to hide it.
they did this very well, and actually kind of shows, in a way, how more sophisticated Japanese culture was against the Western cultures, who were just pirating and pillaging and killing each other. The Japanese culture had done that too in the past, right? The clans constantly warred and they killed each other.
And this is also
assassinated each other.
Yeah, and this is also the start of the Edo period.
Yeah,
that they're basing this off of.
Yeah,
so, as well. So it's the
where Edo 200 becomes the capital.
Yeah, basically. It's for the 200-year peace.
Yeah. all under Toranaga, which, like you said, if you watch, like, a lot of, like, or tons of different Japanese historical stuff, Toranaga is a well-known name.
Mm-hmm.
It's, at one point, Toranaga's a villain, like, in like, Ninja Scroll, the Toranaga clan's a villain. But, like, this is a cool way to see how that came to be, and how it was done without bloodshed.
Yeah.
And, of course, like they always say, like, when you're a hero until one day you find out that you're the
villain,
right?
Yeah.
And that's basically what happens in 200 years of peace. Eventually, the Toranaga clan falls, right? But great show. Definitely recommend it. Should definitely watch it. Except I don't think it needs a season two. Probably won't get a season two.
I doubt it.
Definitely something I would rewatch, or I would watch if somebody hadn't seen it again. Like, hey, let's watch this. It's a good, like, 10-hour story about the about the rise of the Edo period.
Wonderful story, wonderful costuming, wonderful set design, all pretty much shot up in Vancouver, which, interesting enough, the scene with Blackthorn and Fuji out in the bay scattering the ashes, that's the same bay that the original author of Shogun used to live, and his children used to play out in that bay.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So,
I didn't know that.
So, you know, fun fact from the official podcast of Shogun.
Yeah. So,
go watch Shogun. Tao 10 would recommend.
Yes, definitely. Another show we watched was called Renegade Nell. This came on Disney Plus a couple weeks ago.
Yep. All episodes aired at the same time.
March 29th, yeah, basically.
So, we're a little late.
This is an 8-episode show. We took our time kind of going through it. There's some good things about it. There's some bad things about it. Overall, I would say this is not a show I'd watch again.
Fair.
It's an interesting period piece with some supernatural cool stuff in it. Yes, go ahead. I would say, like, this reminds me a lot of Willow, but done better, where, like, the music fit the time period better.
The music was well done in this.
The storyline, the main storyline is decent, but they try to allude to a bigger plot line, which never gets resolved.
Yep.
And
well, they do. I did see that they are trying to do a season two.
Which I can see them doing it, because they definitely left it open for that. But would I watch season two? I don't know. Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other big thing is that, like, the whole premise is that there's this gal, Nell, who basically, I guess, pretended to be a dude and stuck into the military. Finally got kicked out and basically comes home. But on her way home is held by some highwaymen, where then this fairy basically enters her body, and she has super strength and super speed and can catch bullets and all that type of stuff. The thing that annoys me most about this is that they never explain that. And even the fairy's like, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know. I'm just here to be with you.
Yeah.
And has no idea about his own origin, why he gives her powers, why he's doing stuff other than that he won't be a part of, like, reckless violence for violence sake. He's there to protect her, but has no idea why.
Yeah, and we don't know when those two meet either.
Yeah, it just happened while she's being held up by highwaymen.
That's the time that we see it, but it seems like she already knew about the fairy Billy.
I don't think she did, because he introduces himself after the fact. She didn't know who he was.
Oh, well, then how she played it when she was fighting, it seemed like she knew exactly what to do.
She knew she was very, very strong and confident for some reason, I guess. That's the thing, it doesn't get explained, which is what's missing in this story.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic story is that she comes home to her family, to her father, her two sisters, and then the local lord's son is a piece of shit, and basically ends up killing her father.
Her sister
kills her father, and then when she goes to confront the magistrate about it, that, hey, no, you said he was shot while poaching. My father's not a poacher, and yeah, the bullet wound that he has happened after he died. So what the fuck? And then through that confrontation, the son ends up killing his own father to take his place as a magistrate, and then they all blame it on Nell. So then Nell and her family are on the run, while everybody's saying that she killed a magistrate. And that's basically the plot of this, with some more supernatural stuff of her enemies having magical powers, a plot to kill the queen, to replace Queen Anne with
her cousin James from Stewart. From France.
From France or whatnot. But it all comes down to, like, when they end up bringing up a big point, being, oh, no, your point, and the whole reason why we're here is to let the help have the common people rise up and not be treated like shit, where like our enemies here are trying to make sure the common people don't get to vote, don't get to be part of parliament, don't get rights, and it's only the rich aristocrats who get to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Which would have been a great thing to go for, but by the end of the whole show, it's just, cool, my name's cleared, we're going to go home to our pub and live our normal lives.
Yeah.
We orchestrated a prison break where all the poor people got out of one prison in one town, but we didn't really do anything to stop the aristocrats from running everything.
Yeah.
And stop them from imprisoning poor people. We stopped the plot to kill the queen. We got pardoned by the queen, but we didn't do anything else.
Yeah.
So it's like it loses its own plot that it tries to stay for some reason. But like the good things about the show is I feel
costuming,
the actors are really good.
Yes.
As you said it, everybody's the right amount of ugly to fit the time period.
It's not an insult. I don't think it's an insult, but it's not everyone is going to be, you know, perfect face, I'll say.
Yeah, so I was like,
or Botox face.
So like, even Willow being a fantasy world, the problem with Willow is it's very like WB-ish, where everybody's a beautiful person, right?
Gorgeous. Everybody's fuckable.
Even like in a medieval time, though, people are gonna be dirty. They're gonna be ugly. They're not gonna be well kept.
Dirt. It was wonderful.
Yeah, only the aristocrats were the really clean people.
And they were covering all that shit up with powder. And you saw the caked on powder. It was great.
Yeah, I think the casting for who played Nell was perfect. Her family, the people who played her family, all the different villains that they kind of run into. Everything worked out. It's like designed perfectly. It's just the story loses its own plot.
Yeah.
Do a second season, like you said, sounds like that's what they're planning. They left it open for there to be a second season. If you need something to watch and you're kind of bored, I could recommend this, but it's not something that I would say I would watch again.
Yeah, it's not like Shogun where I'm like, ooh, I gotta watch that one again just to see all the intricacies. That was not the word, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. The characters were done very well, for that part of it. This caught my attention because it was like, cool, a period piece of some supernatural stuff.
Yeah.
Sounds interesting. A little mixture of witchcraft. Cool. Let's see where that goes.
I do like that it is darker. You do see blood and it doesn't shy away from darker themes.
Yeah. And I think some people might like the anti-woke people there will sit there and claim that, hey, this is too diverse. There's too many black people or Indian people. They're like, nah, Great Britain had control of India. They definitely would have imported people there. They had indentured servitude, which is brought up here constantly, that people were bought. One of the main people in Nell's party was not necessarily a slave. He was purchased and kept around to keep the kids
entertained.
And then when they didn't need him anymore, they made him a stable boy. But basically, like, the reason why there's a black lord here is probably because indentured servitude, and then he worked his way up to being an earl.
Yeah.
Like, that's very possible to do in England, because, like, their idea of slavery was indentured servitude. You worked your time off. It's just when the Americans picked up the concept, it's like, we don't have to give them indentured servitude. We'll just keep them.
Forever and ever.
Yeah. So, I don't think the diversity thing is messed up. It makes sense why there's some Indian people there, why there's black people there. I don't feel like it's done to a point where it's like, oh my god, this is like shoehorn in there. It fits for the time period, and all the characters fit really well for the period that they're doing, and like I said, the costumes, all that stuff's good.
Mm-hmm.
The story by story for each episode is pretty entertaining and good. It's just the main plot of the whole thing gets lost. So maybe we'll watch season two. I don't know if there's nothing else to watch. Maybe. I mean, that's pretty much why we picked this one. I was like, there's not a whole lot else out after Fallout. Didn't do a like slower release. They just dumped everything all at once.
Yeah.
So basically, we had to watch that as soon as possible to prevent spoilers. But hey, you want a period piece with some supernatural stuff in it? Renegade Nell is on Disney Plus. I'd say definitely go check that out. The next movie that we watched was a new release on Netflix called Susume.
Which came out last year.
Yeah. It finally hit Netflix. This was a anime that had a minor release in the States. Didn't really go have that many theaters that released it, but I've never seen trailers for it. And it's basically really beautiful anime. It's not like it's I you can't say it's Miyazaki level, but it's high level quality anime.
Like Girl Who Leapt Through Time kind of level of animation.
Yeah, really well done. I think there's a few translation issues with it because like
Yes.
we watched it with English dub, which we still got what was going on, but basically I think one of the big one the only one I really noticed was that when she meets the other guy walking down the road and he says, "Hey, where are the ruins?" And she tells him where the ruins are. And then when she sees the when she goes to follow him and sees the door, she's like, "Oh, the door," like he mentions, like he never mentioned a door.
Right.
But I think that's a lost translation thing that in Japanese version he probably did. But basically, she finds this door that has basically a doorway that looks like it goes to another world. She tries to walk through it but can't, and then freaks out and leaves. And then suddenly she sees like what she thought was a fire in the hills, and then turns into
And
this giant thing
like
coming out.
smoke, like snake
Yeah,
type thing.
pillowing out, and then this big snake would go into the air, and then it topples over and hits the land and causes a massive earthquake. She runs back to where the ru this ru these ruins were, where the door was, and finds that the dude's there trying to close this door that this big thing was coming out of. They end up closing the door just to prevent the catastrophe, and that's when we kind of get the plot of the whole thing, which is he's a closer who is like sent to close these different portals, and
To prevent these earthquakes and disasters.
which basically they're saying there's a giant worm or dragon that lives underneath Japan. In this underworld that can get out through these gates, and if he ever gets out, when it crashes down on Earth, it will cause a great catastrophe to happen. Hence the earthquake, which could cause a tsunami and whatnot. This she brings him home where he explains all this because he was injured, and this is where this cat pops up,
Yes.
and she's like, "Oh, it's a cat," and she's like,
Like
"Oh,"
trying to help it and
and
feed
feeds
it.
it. And then the cat starts talking, says, "Oh, I love you, Susume." And it looks at him, says, "I don't like you," and then turns him into a chair.
Yeah. Well, he puts the guy into
The
Satsume's three-legged chair.
chair that she had, it was a keepsake from her mother. Her mother built her a chair
Yep.
that she had lost at one point but had found again, and just had it in her room. He was sitting on it, and boom, he turns into a chair.
Yep. He turns into that chair.
Yeah, and then the cat runs off, and then the chair runs off chasing the
She's,
cat, and people are like, "Oh,
and
look, a
then she
cat."
runs off chasing both of them.
Yeah, and it ends up being this adventure where like she literally leaves her aunt, who is her caretaker, gets on a ferry and goes basically is traveling all across Japan, following this cat, that's basically leading them to these other gates that she has to help him close,
Yep.
to the point where they get all the way to Tokyo, and the which she ends up learning from the guy that hey, there's two
Two
main
keystones.
keystones. The cat was one of the keystones, and then there's another keystone in Tokyo at a gate that they haven't found yet. But in Tokyo, the head of the worm comes out. At the other gate was the tail of the worm. But if the whole worm ever gets out, it's going to cause catastrophe for the whole world. And in Tokyo, that's what's happening. The head of the worm's coming out, ends up being this giant spiral thing above Tokyo. She and the dude who's the chair get it to the point where they can stop it. But that's where he realizes being the chair means he's the keystone now and not the cat, because the cat tells him like, "I'm not the keystone, and I can't do it. You have to do it." So she then uses him as the keystone and puts the worm back into the world.
And then the third half is her trying to get him out of it and not be the keystone anymore.
Yeah, and it does that classic thing Japanese animes really do, where it's like love at first sight and like soulmate, like boom, they're meant to be together, and she just knows. So after they basically save the world, because while this worm was out, even the cat told like, "Hey, if you don't do this, when it falls, the world's going to break, and you can't let that happen." So she saves the world by sacrificing him, and he sacrifices himself to being the keystone, but then is determined like, "I'm going to find a way to bring him back." And then this is where like another cat shows up, a black cat eventually shows up, which ends up being the keystone in Tokyo.
And where she needs to go is her original home up north. And so they have like a big old trip.
She's there with her friend. Her aunt finally catches up with her, who thinks that she's dating the friend. He's like,
who's like a playboy.
Because she thinks that some man stole her niece away from her and is running around. But like, she's like, no, we need to go here. I need to find the original door, because she keeps having dreams of her mother where she was looking for her after her mother had died.
Mm-hmm.
And she found her way into this starry world, which is what she saw in the door the first time, to where she's like, oh, I need to go here. And maybe I can find him and find a way to bring him back so he's not the Keystone anymore. And that's when this big black cat shows up that, for some reason, was giving negative thoughts to the mother, to the aunt. They don't explain it at all. But it turns out,
like another kind of lost in translation, I think, for that explanation.
But basically, the two cats are together and they're yin and yang, right?
Yes.
So the small white one is the good side. The big black one can produce negative thoughts and stuff out of people. But they all get together. They're all traveling there to the point where then the two cats and her end up going on their own because when the cats start talking, the guy freaks out and he
crashes his car
into a ditch. So, like, she leaves and goes until she can.
And the aunt follows on a bike. And so her and the aunt are riding the bike.
With the cats.
And it's kind of cute. It's a cute little
trip story. Yeah. Because, like, throughout all this, from her trip from her small little island at the south end of Japan all the way to Tokyo, she meets all these different families and these different people who help her out on her trip.
Mm-hmm.
Very much, which is Japanese culture, where people are like, oh, what are you doing here? Let me help you.
Yeah.
Let me take you
here.
You
need food? You need this?
Yeah. Like, she found a tangerine farm that let her stay there the night, and that helped her out. Then she found a woman who was a host who owned a bar.
A hostess bar.
Who was raising two kids, who, like, let her stay there the night and helped her out. And then she went on her way as she went to Tokyo. As they go to this up north into Hokkaido, where she was originally from, and they find the door there,
mm-hmm.
that's where she was told, like, if you find that door, that's the one door you can go through as a living person to go to this world where only the dead can go. She goes there, is able to get the dude back, but also sees herself as a child. And this dream that she was having was that she thought she saw her mother come, and her mother gave her the chair back. But it was actually her there with him giving the chair to herself,
mm-hmm.
trying to tell, like, hey, it's going to be okay in the future. You'll be all right. And then sent her younger self back to the path, back out the door to where she was in her past. And then she can move on to the future.
Yeah, and she can finally let go of her past.
Yeah. It's a nice, really beautiful story. And like I said, mm-hmm. it invoked the same emotions that The Girl Who Left Through Time did, which was a story about a girl who kept going back in time for her own benefits, but not realizing it was changing everyone else's life, who then ultimately has to go back and reset everything so everyone else's life is better. It kind of had that feeling to where, like, she took on a mission that wasn't her own problem, decided to do it, stayed very positive about the whole thing, ran into people who were very helpful for her. Nobody was trying to take advantage of her and type of stuff like that. A very wholesome story, which you don't get that type of stuff anymore.
Yeah.
Like, if this was American Tale, there'd be people trying to fuck her over or trying to take advantage of a young student traveling across the country by herself.
Yeah. I love this. This was great.
Yeah. The animation is very beautiful.
The story's wonderful. Yeah. I loved all three acts.
Yeah, it just had the third act was just like kind of like
it just kind of it just third act
becomes a road trip of these three people and this cat that are like, oh,
what?
Okay, what's going on?
But once you get into it, you're like, oh, okay, I'm in here. I'm into it now.
Yeah. It's on Netflix called Susume. I definitely recommend watching it. If you like mm-hmm. anime, you'll definitely love it. If you're new to anime, it's an interesting story. Like I said, there's some things that are kind of lost in translation. But that happens with anime when they dub it. You can watch it subbed if you want. That might make it a little bit clearer. But I think there's some things, like, specifically with the cats and the keystones, is that that's probably more so something that is assumed you already know about Japanese culture.
Right.
Versus somebody not knowing anything about it and just knowing, oh, that they're yin and yang. And that's how those cats are. That was something you just had to assume. They don't really explain it. But still, really good movie, beautiful music. Definitely say check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to some gaming news. There's two games I want to talk about. One I've played today, and it's a real short game. It's only about an hour and a half.
Okay.
It's called The Beginner's Guide. I heard about this because, like, people were recommending it as, like, hey, if you ever need to know get out of writer's block or learn something more about like why you want to create stuff, play this game. It's just a narrative game by the guy who made the Stanley Parable.
Oh, nice.
It's very interesting. It's him telling a story about how he met this person at a game jam, and this guy would make games, and from like 2008 to 2011, and then he stopped making games. Mm-hmm. And it goes with you exploring all these little games that he made, which were like really, really short like experiences. That he, as he walks you through, he tells you how he changes it, like why these things are here, to where the narrative ends up changing into being that the guy narrating it is telling a story about how this guy making these games is basically in a dark place, like he's suddenly alone, he feels locked off, and you're getting that impression from the games of your meal because that's kind of the narrative that's being told to you, to where you stand where the narration becomes like, no, the guy wasn't happy that you were sharing his games with other people, that you thought getting the feedback from other people that they are good and the validation is what you need, and you're striving for validation all the time. That's what you need, and that the guy sharing this other dude's games was getting that validation. But when the guy stopped making games, he had no longer anything to share with anyone else. To the point where, like, there's literally a message that says, hey, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Please stop contacting me.
Oh, gosh.
And the point was like, why'd you put this lamppost in my games? Why did you change my games to this? Why are you sharing my games to other people against my wishes? Like, stop this. This means you have more problems, not me. The fact that you think I have problems says more about you than me. To where the guy goes like through this existential crisis of like, oh, I'm the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one that's seeking validation. And I made this guy's, what he enjoyed in making games, I ended up making it so he did not like making games.
Right.
So it's very interesting. A lot of people said like, hey, they can't really explain. I mean, I just explained to you what happens in that game. I think it's very explainable, but it has a very positive on
Steam.
It's like over 16,000 reviews, very positive. It's only a $10 game. And it's short enough that I think it's worth playing. I think people will get different things out of it, for sure. I thought it was very interesting as a narrative, because even the Stanley Parable is an interesting narrative of a game. And I said, like, it's a cool story that gets told to you. It's interesting to hear how it gets flipped on to being the narrator having the issue, to a point where I almost feel like the guy he's talking about making the game is actually himself, and himself not wanting to share stuff, but he pushing it out there, than him chasing the validation of people. Like I said, you can get... You probably have to play it multiple times to see get different stuff out of it. But very fun game. I definitely recommend it. It's called The Beginner's Guide. It's an indie game. It's on Steam for $10.
Nice.
Only about like an hour and a half total time to play. You'll probably really enjoy it.
Okay.
Other game that came out basically today on Game Pass, is called Yuuden Chronicle 100 Heroes, which is a JRPG. Now, there was a prequel that was out on Game Pass prior and probably still is called... Yuuden Chronicle Rising, which is the prelude to this story. But the interesting thing...
Would you need to play it?
I don't think you have to, because I didn't play it. Or at least I started it, but I never played through all the way through it. This is a classic JRPG, but it has really cool visuals. Almost on the level of Octopath Traveler, but stylized a little bit differently. The unique thing about it is that there's 100 different playable characters in the game.
Okay.
It does a weird thing, which I think the... prequel probably turned me off on it, is it has an auto mode. So, like, when you get into a fight, you can just hit auto and the characters will decide what they're going to do.
Oh, okay.
So, almost like you don't have to play it. The UI is not that much of overblown, like some JRPGs nowadays where, like, they seem almost like a mobile game. So, the UI is not as intrusive. But I was playing, I was going auto for a little bit, and I went back to playing manual, and I can see the strategy that you can use there with the different characters you can set up. For like first hour and a half, actually very interesting. It does have like the same like kind of lulls I feel like JRPGs have, where it's like, cool, you enter a room, walk 5 steps, stop, we're gonna have a short conversation where someone's saying, oh, this is interesting, and then it goes back to letting you play. It's like, you didn't need to do that. You didn't even stop my gameplay to help me have like 2 lines of dialogue. And then let me go back to exploring the dungeon.
Yeah.
Just play. Just like,
let me play. You could talk in the background.
Yeah. But the art styles and of all the different attacks and stuff the characters can do is pretty well done. and the fact that there's 100 different characters to see all that, how it all comes together, mm-hmm. should be fairly interesting. Has really, really good music in it. So it being on Game Pass, I can definitely say I recommend checking out. It's probably one that will take you a long time to get through.
especially if you want to play all 100 characters.
Because, yeah, basically there's like 3 main characters in the game. As far as I know right now, you play as one of them. But you'll meet up with these other characters. And yet, all 3 of them will connect to all through the 100 different heroes throughout the game that you get mm-hmm. to play as. Yeah, it looks like you get to change. You end up changing narratives and playing as other people here. But it's those 3 main characters are the main focus. And then they connect themselves to all these different characters. Who, in the end, will probably all culminate to some huge, cool, badass fight.
A giant battle.
Yeah, so we'll just have to see where it goes from there. Definitely interesting. Yeah. If you like JRPGs, you'll probably really enjoy this. If you're new to JRPGs, this is very interesting. One big complaint about Octopath Traveler was with all the cool art design and all the cool characters, they never interacted with each other as far as the storylines went. Where here, they are interacting with each other. You don't feel like the people in your party don't know what the other person's going through. Like, they're all talking and interacting together. Where Octopath Traveler was like, all right, I'm going to do this person's storyline. Nobody else seemed to care or know that that was going on and or react to it or have anything to say about it. It was just, okay, cool. Now we're going to do your story and nobody's going to care about what you're doing either. So, like I said, it's on Game Pass. Definitely interesting to play. So definitely check it out. That's it for now. I mean, I'm probably going to jump back into Fallout 4 tomorrow once the update comes out.
Okay.
See how they updated that. But there's not a whole lot of other games worth checking out until the end of summer, it seems. I think Indiana Jones is the next big game mm-hmm. that we're interested in buying. And maybe Star Wars Outlaws.
But again, we need to see.
We have to see more about that. I'm probably going to wait to see what reviews say about the game and whether or not we buy it at launch or wait till it goes on sale later on.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, until like an E3 or showcase, there's not a whole lot of what's coming out that will be interesting. So we'll have to see what might be released.
Yep. And then we'll need to find some more shows to watch.
We'll probably check out Kung Fu Panda 4 next week.
Okay. Because that's out. Know what else is out for video right now? Dune Part 2.
Yeah.
Get your Dune buckets, people.
Yeah, Dune is definitely a good thing to rent or watch on demand, I would say. If you're a Dune fan, definitely buy it. Otherwise, check it out on the whole streaming services. I'm sure it'll end up on Max here pretty soon, too.
Yep.
But definitely
really But you good. Can buy it right now or rent it. So
yeah.
It's cheaper than going to the theater, but it is still really nice to see in the theater.
Yeah, I'd still say rent it, but I'm not that huge of a Dune fan that say I want to buy that movie and add it to my collection.
Fair.
But I think for a remake of from where the old to new one now is, it's a good retelling of the story, and probably a little bit easier to follow this story than it was the original 1984 one.
Mm-hmm.
Or
you could read the books, you know, all 9 of them.
Yeah, lots of books. All right, that's our show this week, so we will catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
Bye.